Most of us can relate to having a nagging, nitpicking, negative voice in our heads that feeds us an endless stream of commentary and bad advice. This voice is like a sadistic coach whose backwards goal is to put us down or hold us back. Well, it turns out there's actually a term for this mean and distorted line of thinking, and it's fittingly called our critical inner voice.
The critical inner voice is a concept frequently discussed by our father, Dr. Robert Firestone, and our sister, Dr. Lisa Firestone. For the past 30 years, they've both done extensive research assessing the frequency at which people experience these thoughts or voices, the most common of these voices, where these voices come from, and how they limit us in our lives. They've written books, developed a therapy methodology to help people understand and overcome their critical inner voice. They've even developed an assessment scale of destructive thoughts to determine someone's risk for suicide and violence.
So today we'll once again be joined by Lisa, and we'll dive into the subject of the critical inner voice. We'll talk about where this voice comes from, how it manifests itself, and the many ways it impacts our daily lives and relationships. And finally, we'll ask Lisa to explain the five fundamental steps we can all take to overcome this inner critic, which we just can't seem to shut up. I'm Lena Firestone.
And I'm Carolyn Firestone.
And in this podcast, we'll ask, why do we listen to our inner critic?
So Lisa, for starters, we'll just ask you, what is the critical inner voice?
So the critical inner voice is a system of thinking negatively about yourself. And often there are certain patterns that we have. There's ways that we put ourselves down. It's part of a whole negative self-image that we have. It's the part of us that is turned against us. And it really is made up of thoughts that are both self-critical and self-protective, but that in general interfere with us going after or having the things we want in life and really enjoying our life and even being in our experience, because the chatter in our head often takes us out of being in whatever we're experiencing in the moment. So the critical inner voice is an internal dialogue of thinking negatively about ourselves and suspiciously and critically about others as well.
A lot of people talk about their inner voice as being a positive thing, like a guiding light for, you know, their true self. And you've talked about people being divided between their real self and this critical inner voice. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, we really do see people as basically being divided. And again, this is the theory of our father, Dr. Robert Firestone. But basically that all of us are divided. Part of us wants to live, is goal-directed, is life-affirming, but part of us is self-critical, self-hating, at its ultimate end, self-destructive. And that language of that anti-self is the critical inner voice. So I do think there is a part of us that is our real self. And I think part of how we listen to that part is not so much talking to ourselves from outside of ourselves, because again, that's being separate from ourselves instead of really being ourselves. But it's really about paying attention to those things that light you up. What are those situations when you feel the most yourself? What are those people when you're around them you feel the most yourself? When are those people when you're around them your voice is the quietest? What activities do you get engaged in and you really just feel like at the top of your game and really good? And it's important for everybody to have those things. You know, that's how you build real self-esteem or a real sense of your abilities. And you feel at peace when you're in kind of in that state of mind or in those kinds of activities. When you find yourself with a lot of clatter in your head, you're probably listening to your critical inner voice. You're probably against yourself. When you put yourself in situations that you actually feel worse when you come out of them. If you are around people that, you know, have a critical attitude towards you, whether it's friends or peers or whether it's a spouse or whether it's, you know, your parents, you're going to get back into an old feeling about yourself. You know, those inputs really do have an impact.
What are some examples of how this voice can affect you? Why shouldn't we listen to it?
Well, I think the reason we shouldn't listen to it is because it's always against us. And it'll play both sides of the coin. So it'll say, have that extra piece of cake, you know, you've really been good on your diet, it won't matter, which sounds friendly, right? But then if you act on that, it's your weak-willed jerk, you went off your diet. You know, there you go, being a fat slob again. So it plays both sides of the coin. It never contributes to positive behaviors. And a lot of people say, well, that's just the way I am. It's realistic when it comes to me. I'm bad, I'm evil, I'm stupid. But the reality is, it's a very unfriendly attitude toward ourselves, and that's never appropriate to have toward yourself. Even if there's something you don't like about yourself, beating yourself up about it doesn't change it. So if you have an addictive pattern, for instance, or you drink too much, or you overeat, those, you know, yes, those are good behaviors to stop for your own health or self-interest, but beating yourself up about it isn't what contributes to that. What contributes to changing it is having a compassionate attitude toward yourself, where you're friendly toward yourself and you can look at the not-so-good stuff without beating yourself up or having to defend against it, but just have a realistic, compassionate attitude toward yourself and say, actually, I want to feel better about myself, so I think I'll go on a diet, or I want to feel better about myself, so I'm going to try not drinking and see if that changes things for me. And when we take that attitude that's more friendly and compassionate, we're actually more likely to change it. Because when we beat ourselves up, we feel more distress and psychological pain, and then we want to soothe that pain, so we go back to what soothes it. So it's never in our own interest, even when it seems like it is. Like, you know, don't tell him you love him because you're just going to get humiliated. When we tell ourselves those kind of things, they seem self-protective and maybe sensible at times, but they're not, because we're holding back how we really feel. In essence, we're saying no to ourselves rather than letting other people say no to us. That's not a helpful stance to take. Why not go for the things you really want in your life?
You've been a practicing therapist for over 2 decades, and I know you've done a lot of research with prisoners and high school students in various populations. How common do you find this voice to be?
We find it's extremely common, and we find that I haven't found any group of people who don't have these negative thoughts. In fact, one time my colleague Joyce Catlett and I were actually up giving a presentation in Vancouver, and it was during a beauty pageant, and they were wanted to interview us about the beauty pageant because they wanted to say, don't beauty pageants make young girls feel bad about themselves? And aren't we holding up this kind of unrealistic idea of beauty and then making everybody else feel bad? They said, but of course, the people in the pageant, you know, these very accomplished, very beautiful women don't have any critical inner voices. And we're like, no, ask them, go interview them. And they did, and they all had critical thoughts toward themselves. So these people who we would hold up as being like so special or, you know, the ideal, still have critical inner voices. And that's true from people who are prisoners and who have done really, in the case of people I interviewed, some very violent things. People who were very suicidal at one time or made serious suicide attempts all talk about these critical inner voices. And I see it throughout my practice, whether it's somebody coming to me for marital problems or difficulty with their parenting or serious psychological issues themselves, that everybody has these critical inner voices. And interestingly enough, when we were doing research, even very young children can identify these very critical inner voices. Children as young as age 5 can tell you what their negative thoughts are about themselves.
Are there some people who just don't have these critical inner voices?
The only people I've found who don't identify with having critical inner voices fall into one of two camps. One camp are people who just so much believe these negative ways of seeing themselves that it's really, they don't see them as critical inner voices. They just feel so integral to who they are as a person. I just am this bad person. This badness is just inside of me. And usually they've had a lot of negative directed toward them, and they just have so identified that that's their identity, and they are just so tightly merged with it, it's really hard for them to see it at all as a critical inner voice. The other camp are people who most of their critical inner voices are suspicious and negative towards others. And so they will tell you how their employees are cheating on them, or what's wrong with them, and what's wrong with their spouse and their children and you and anybody else they see. They're very quick to judge. So most of their negative thinking, their enemy coach is saying all these bad things about the people around them, which then is self-protective and feels, you know, like they're okay. But that enemy coach is destroying their lives because, first of all, people were picking up on their negativity, and that does not inspire people to treat them particularly well. So when you have this very outward, you know, projection of your voice and just being very critical towards everybody else, that can also seem like you don't have any voices, but those voices are actually really shaping your life and causing a lot of destruction to others as well.
I think it's easy for people to relate to the idea of these critical inner voices that essentially criticize us and sound sort of mean and hateful toward ourselves and others, as you said at times. But you've also talked about how the critical inner voice can be more subtle or sneaky and have kind of a self-soothing, friendly tone to it. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think there's really two parts to this anti-self that you mentioned before, Carolyn. There's these two parts. There's the ways we're turned on ourselves, but there's also the ways that we're trying to soothe ourselves. So I think really what happens is that very early on, and to the degree that we feel deprived or we feel pain as an infant, we start to parent ourselves, both punishing ourselves and soothing ourselves the way we were treated early on. And I think that's the origin of both the self-punishing part of that critical inner voice, but also the self-soothing part. And the self-soothing part is often saying things like, you know, just be by yourself, you know, you don't really want to go out tonight, and it sounds all friendly, and you're going to take some me time, and, you know, you could put all these kinds of spins on it that sound positive. But then you're alone at home and you start thinking, oh, you're such a loser because you never go out and nobody likes you. And your friends are all having a good time without you. They don't really mind that you're not there because you're really not very significant, you know. And then you start to feel horrible about yourself. So they seem friendly. But there's also ones like, you know, don't trust another person. And it seems self-protective, like, oh, you know, you really have to, you know, watch out, or he's probably, you know, really doesn't really care about you, or maybe he's going to cheat on you. And, you know, we think we're protecting ourselves and we're being smart, but we're actually just making ourselves tortured. And it's not a very constructive way to think about other people. When we think that way, we act badly towards others. And it can actually lead to violence and aggression at its ultimate end when we're very self-protective and we're very suspicious and paranoid towards others. It's almost we can strike before, in what we think of as self-defense, before the person's done anything. And we do this in our relationships. So our partner says something, we take it as a slight. Maybe it wasn't even a slight. And we lash back, and then pretty soon that puts them on the defensive and we're into it. The other thing about the self-soothing part is it kind of limits you. Oh, you don't really like to do that. That's too hard for you. So don't even try. You know, and I give myself as an example. I was a very shy person in school. I don't think I ever spoke till graduate school, hardly at all ever in a class. But, you know, now when it came to doing public speaking, I thought I would never do that. But, you know, somebody encouraged me to do it. And it was partly this thing of I'm too shy. I can't do it. I would have just said automatically, you know, to anything like that. And then, you know, when I started to do it, I actually started to like it. And now it's part of what I enjoy is teaching and doing that kind of thing. But, you know, it's one of those things, if I had listened to a self-protective voice, I never would have done, and I would have never found a part of myself. So that part about, you know, going for the things you really want, or that inner guiding light of what your real self is, a lot of times we don't know because there's so many of these overlays on who we would have been without getting bent out of shape in small ways and big ways in our growing up that we don't even know who we are. Now, did I have a shy temperament? Maybe. But was it reinforced? Probably. And did I, you know, it got to be a way I defined myself, because being quiet in my family was a good strategy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you have strategies that worked for you as a kid, that's another reason people don't like to give these up, is because they felt life-preserving or necessary when we were growing up, and they were the best strategy we could come up with at the time. But they don't serve us later in our life. And they often are the exact thing that's limiting us later in our life. And those behaviors are really supported by the critical inner voice, mm-hmm. and even directed, if you will.
So it sounds like your critical inner voice really starts to come about pretty early in life, partly based on adaptations, or as you just called them, strategies that you form in response to your environment. Can you explain what causes children to develop these critical inner voices?
They come from a number of sources. They come from things that were actually said, but not that most parents say you're ugly or you're stupid, but they often say things like that about themselves. So it's not only what your parents say to you, but how they feel about themselves. One of the most striking findings that we've had is how similar negative thoughts are from one generation to the next. So in one tape that I often show, there's a mother who had a really horrendous childhood with lots of abuse and lots of neglect. And anybody would think it was an abusive childhood who heard the details of it. And she has thoughts that she never should have been born in the first place, that nobody wanted her. And it's hard for her to accept that she has a lot in her life today. You know, it doesn't fit with her idea about herself. But her daughter, who was a very wanted child, who never experienced that kind of abuse or neglect, has that same basic thought about herself, that she never should have been born. Now, how did she get that? She picked up on her mother's way of feeling about herself. And the take-home message to parents about this is you have to feel good about yourself. You can't afford to sit around and hate yourself, because that will affect how your child feels about themselves. they identify with you, they hear you talk to yourself, because often out loud we call ourselves stupid or fat as we're in front of the mirror, or various things, and the child feels that way about themselves.
If a child picks up on a certain attitude from a parent that wasn't necessarily directed toward them outwardly or verbally, what are some of the ways that they still wind up turning this against themselves?
Right. Well, I think that in all childhoods that there's hurt and pain. And, you know, as children, it's way too threatening to see the faults in our parents, because that's just too scary. That idea that we might be in the hands of people who have faults is not really a wonderful thought for a child. It's actually very terrifying for a small child. And so it's much easier to feel like they're bad. If I just act good, then they'll love me. And they attach that bad or whatever hurt feelings they have to all kinds of things. The way they look, perhaps, or, you know, how they're achieving at school, or how they are at sports, or how they compare with their peers. So they come from multiple sources, you know. And sometimes older siblings can be mean or tease or I think of one patient I have who was the youngest in her family, and she always felt like the baby, and they always sort of made fun of her because, you know, she was much younger than her siblings and she couldn't do what they did, and they would kind of taunt her with it. And it's hard for her still not to feel like she's broken or there's something wrong with her, even though now she just turned 50. You know, it's like it doesn't go away. I also think that parents say a lot more than they think they do to kids, often with the idea of being helpful. You know, sit up straight, or you need to try harder, or things like that that seem friendly or like you're trying to help. But they feel like continual picking to the person. You know, can't you be more like this person? Or why aren't you more like your brother? Or why aren't you more like your sister or that other child over there who acts so good and obedient? You know, it's really kind of amazing how much parents do that, or, you know, encouraging your kid to try their hardest, which implies that they're not trying, right? And so all those things that can seem like they're just helpful parental criticisms or advice often get internalized in as part of, oh, that's why you sometimes act mean to me, or you don't like me, or I feel like you don't love me as much as my brother or sister or whatever.
I do think the intergenerational aspect of it is really interesting, because you think about all the qualities you get handed down from your parents and from their parents, and people think about, you know, genes and all these things, but you don't think about this critical piece of it, because I think a lot of people feel like it's just a part of them. It's their conscience, or it's just their identity, but they don't think of it as something separate from them that was actually, you know, put upon them.
So the intergenerational piece is interesting because, yes, there are genetics, obviously, but there also are, we pick up on our parents' trauma very directly. It turns out that the thing that plagues us the most is unresolved trauma from generation to generation. So when we don't resolve those traumas, that's when we pass them along. So for people who are parents, the way not to pass along the critical inner voice to break the chain is to really work on having more self-compassion, having a friendlier attitude toward yourself, treating yourself with kindness, not judging yourself, taking a step back from your thoughts and feelings and knowing they're just thoughts and feelings passing through. They don't define you. Being a bit more mindful in that way. And also realizing that you suffer just like everybody else suffers, and that you're not different because you have these thoughts. You're very much the same because you have these thoughts as other people. And when you think that way, you have a more compassionate attitude toward yourself and toward other people. So that helps break the chain too. But you have to start to separate it. And in that, you have to be able to or willing to see what caused you to have these thoughts. Not because you want to blame your parents, because, you know, the reality is parents don't give these to you because they want to. People do usually want the best for their children, almost always. But they inadvertently, by the bad way they feel about themselves, pass it along. So for anybody, resolving any unresolved trauma is a good idea, because it's going to help you be better in relationships. But to resolve it, you have to feel the pain of it and make sense of it. And part of that making sense of your critical inner voice is, where did it come from? You didn't get this way from nowhere. I don't believe you were born this way. I think these things come from our actual experiences. You know, the ways we interpret our experiences. And in order not to pass it on another generation, we have to realize what was traumatic. We have to develop a compassionate attitude toward ourselves. And we really have to start to address these critical inner voices.
why do you think it's so hard for people to do this? As adults, why is it hard for people to tune out their inner critic? What makes them so compelled to listen to it so that it can last throughout their lifetime?
I think by the time we grow up, we feel really comfortable with it. We're used to having the company of this commentary kind of on everything we do. And in a way, when I've seen people really break away from this or feel kind of free of critical inner voices, they also feel more lonely. It's almost like this companionship. And I think also that old image of ourselves keeps us connected to our family of origin. We are who we were in that family, the broken little sister, the one with a good personality, but not the smart one or the pretty one like our older sisters, or whatever it might be. And those identities, if we break away from those and recognize parts of us that weren't acknowledged in our family, we often feel on very unfamiliar ground or like we don't know ourselves. And we also feel the breaking of that bond or that connection with our family of origin. So that leaves us feeling alone as well. And so I think people are kind of afraid to be without the critical inner voice, to really take their own side. It feels very unfamiliar. It feels like maybe you're building yourself up to not say I'm not stupid. No, you actually probably are not stupid. And even if you were of sub-average intelligence, to call yourself stupid wouldn't help. It doesn't make your IQ go up. It just makes you feel bad. So I think that's the reason that people are so hesitant to give it up. They are afraid not to believe this about themselves.
So if people want to get rid of their critical inner voice, what are the steps they would take to start to do this?
So one of the things is you first have to call them out. You have to realize they are critical inner voices. It can help to write them down at the end of the day. But it's better to write them as you statements than I statements. So it's not, I'm stupid, I'm fat, I was so, you know, everything went wrong in my day. I did everything wrong. I'm, you know, such a failure. It's, you're so stupid. You made everything go wrong with your day. Because when we separate it and put it in the second person, we start to realize that this point of view is separate from ourselves. Also, if we let ourselves go with that second person format, we often start with thoughts we're aware of on the surface, but what we get to is much more core beliefs about ourselves, like that we're unlovable or that we weren't wanted or that we shouldn't have been born in the first place or whatever it might have been. And getting to those core beliefs is important because those core beliefs often inform a whole way of seeing our world. You know, we see it in terms, we have a schema or an idea of our world based on these core beliefs. So getting to them is important. Then it's important to sort of take a step back and think about, where did these thoughts come from? When did I start to think this way about myself? And sometimes when people have gotten into their critical inner voices, and especially along with the feeling that goes with them, which is often a lot of emotion behind these critical inner voices, it isn't a friendly process. It's usually very angry, nasty, sometimes very sort of superior and cynical. And when we can start to identify it, that helps us get some compassion for ourselves. Then it's important to really answer back to that thought process and say something that's more realistic about yourself, more compassionate perspective. And, you know, sometimes people want to get angry back at the things that hurt them. So they have a lot of to say back that's pretty angry. And that's fine. And that's important. And you can get into that with the feeling. Again, a lot of interesting things will come out. You'll learn a lot about how your childhood looked to you as a child, from a child's perspective. But you also need to say something that's just a realistic, compassionate perspective on yourself. Like, yeah, sometimes I make mistakes, but I try really hard, or, you know, whatever it is. It's not that I'm perfect, because you probably aren't. Most people aren't. But, you know, a more realistic, compassionate perspective. And then it's really important to think about, how are these thoughts affecting me in my life today? What things do I want to do that I'm talking myself out of? You know, so I'm interested in that person, but I'm not showing it because I think they would reject me, or I want a new job, but I'm not trying for it because I think nobody will hire me. And then it might be taking the steps towards doing those things. So the ways the voice is holding you back. But it's also often directing you to engage in a lot of self-sabotaging, potentially self-destructive behavior. So then it's resisting acting on the advice of your critical inner voice to, you know, lash out at your spouse, or the advice of your critical inner voice to overeat, you know, like, you know, it it doesn't matter, you know, and you really like this food, so why shouldn't you eat it, you know, or whatever it is, or engage in even more self-destructive behavior like hurting yourself physically. You know, then you have to resist acting against those things. When you go against the critical inner voice, you feel anxious. It really does cause a lot of anxiety come up. But the reality is there's no positive change without anxiety. You get into a new relationship. It's exciting and fun, but it makes you anxious. You have a change in your life, like you decide to become a parent. You're having a baby. That's exciting, but it also causes anxiety. So anxiety is a good sign that you're probably on the cutting edge of doing something new. But initially, the thoughts get louder, almost like a parent screaming at you to get back into line. How dare you send out your resume? Now you're really going to look like an idiot. Or how dare you apply to those, you know, really prestigious colleges? Now you're just going to feel like such an idiot. And then, you know, it's just keeping on with the behavior, even though the voice is yelling at you to stop. And the image I like to give people is of a monster. It's just like this monster lives inside of you. And every time you give into your critical inner voice, you're feeding it. And it takes more and more control over your life. You want to starve this monster. It's not going to like it. It's going to yell and scream and throw a tantrum like the witch in Wizard of Oz at the end, you know, when they throw the water on her tantrum. But it's going to melt. It's going to die without fueling it. And a lot of what we do by our behavior of acting on the critical inner voice is we're growing it. You want the person to shrink it by really going against their critical inner voice. And it will get weaker, and it will fade into the background. It doesn't mean you'll never have that thought again, but it won't, first of all, be as frequent. It won't be with the intensity, and it won't hold so much sway over what you actually do. So it won't be directing your life.
So if someone, after listening to this podcast, wants more information or to find ways to proactively get rid of their critical inner voice, what are some suggestions you would have for them?
Well, one thing they could do is they could go to one of our webinars we have about the critical inner voice. We also have an e-course about overcoming self-sabotage that can be helpful, that really gives you exercises and information to help you to start to recognize these thoughts and also start to overcome them and take actions to go against them. And also our book, Conquer Your Critical Inner Voice, we wrote specifically about that with exercises and journaling things to do on a regular basis. And I often suggest people do it with a friend. Because your friend's going to be more objective about what might be your critical inner voice and what might be a more compassionate point of view about you than you are going to be. You might be for them as well. And it can be really helpful to start to identify these critical inner voices. So those are some of the ways. But it's just paying attention to and writing those thoughts down at the end of the day is a good way to start to get in touch with it. And just to question whether these critical inner voices are true. So the next time you find yourself calling yourself an idiot or saying you look like a fool or whatever it might be, criticizing something about your appearance, you might think, is that a critical inner voice? You know, and to at least put a question behind it and just to recognize, oh, I'm really criticizing myself today. You know, what might that be about? And why is today different than yesterday, you know? Because often we go from our world looking pretty good to us, our friendships, our relationships, our work, and everything seems pretty good, to, oh my God, my life is horrible, I have nothing in it, nobody likes me, nobody cares about me, everything's terrible, I'm ruining everybody's life who does care about me. Oh my gosh. And yet nothing usually has changed very much from day to day in our life. That is a sign that you might have been into your critical inner voice.
Thank you so much for talking to us today.
We really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, you're really welcome. It really feels good to think about this. I think it's always a good reminder for ourselves. And I think it's also, you know, I found it really helpful for people to start to think about it this way and develop a different attitude toward themselves.
If you'd like to learn more about the critical inner voice, please visit our website, psychalive.org. For those of you who are interested in learning more about voice therapy, a therapy method developed by our father, Dr. Robert Firestone, to help people identify and overcome their critical inner voice, we've created a brief bonus podcast in which Lisa explains the 5 steps of voice therapy. And you'll actually hear clips of someone going through some of these steps with Robert Firestone. So if you're interested, you can check that out. Thank you again for listening today. Why Do We is produced by Psych Alive and the Glendon Association. You can listen to more episodes or subscribe at psychalive.org or wherever you find your podcasts.